From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
President Trump's opening offer. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. America's dealmaker-in-chief has proposed a budget so draconian it's already called dead on arrival in Congress. Massive cuts in domestic programs would fund the biggest jump in military spending since Ronald Reagan faced down the Soviet Union. But many Republicans are disturbed that the biggest losers would be in rural areas where Trump himself won the most votes. Democrats are predictably outraged over threats to environmental protection and help for the working poor. The give and take is just beginning. Later on today's Talking Point, an American threat of preemptive action against North Korea. First, here's the news.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. A massive increase for the Pentagon at the expense of domestic programs. We heard about the winners and losers in President Trump's first proposed budget. Today's Talking Point, fatigue sidelined Secretary of State Rex Tillerson today on his visit to South Korea, but he's on to China after suggesting the U.S. might use preemptive action if North Korea continues its nuclear buildup. First, this news update. German Chancellor Angela Merkel arrived at the White House today at a moment of unusual tension between both Washington, between Washington and both her country and the United Kingdom. Charles Kupchan was President Obama's special assistant for European affairs. He's currently with the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome back to our program.
Good to be back with you, Warren.
In the meeting they had previous to their meeting behind closed doors, which hasn't ended yet, the two leaders appeared to be visibly tense. A reporter asked, finally, how about a handshake? And they didn't have one. Are you surprised by that?
Well, we know that coming into this meeting, they have exchanged words verbally, publicly, with President Trump saying that Merkel's immigration policy was catastrophic, and Merkel has shot back. So they don't see eye to eye, and they couldn't be further apart in terms of personality. But yeah, it is a little bit surprising that they didn't start off the meeting with a handshake. Maybe we'll get a better sense later in the day as to how the conversation went.
The chancellor brought with her star cast of CEOs from BMW and Siemens and IBM in Germany. And I understand there was some thought of giving the president a tutorial on trade.
Well, one of the issues that divides the two leaders is trade. And President Trump's trade policy is still a work in progress, but he has said things that suggest he's going to move in a protectionist direction. And one of the countries that he's complained about is Germany because of Germany's trade surplus with the United States. One of the things that Germany does well is it has an apprentice program for its manufacturing sector, and it has therefore developed a highly trained and skilled sector in machine tools and electronics, VWs, BMWs. They haven't experienced the same loss of manufacturing jobs that the United States has. And so I think part of what Merkel is doing is saying, here, let us show you how this system it works and how it may apply to your own manufacturing sector. But another piece of the puzzle is that Germany does need to increase its domestic spending. Merkel has been very tight-fisted, very determined to cling to austerity. And that's one of the reasons that Germany isn't importing more goods from the United States.
What about NATO?
Well, you know, they've been in very different places. As a candidate, President Trump was dismissive of NATO. At one point, he called it obsolete. He has since, I think it was in his address to Congress, where he for the first time came out and said, I support the alliance. I stand behind the alliance. Now the issue is defense spending. He has been harping on the fact that many allies of the United States don't shoulder their fair share of the burden. The NATO target figure is 2% of GDP on defense. Germany is closer to 1%. So I think there Trump does have a legitimate complaint, and hopefully America will agree to increase defense spending, partly to buttress the alliance, but also because that kind of domestic spending is exactly what Germany needs to help stimulate growth in Germany and across the EU.
The economy minister of Germany has even threatened to sue before the World Trade Organization if, in fact, the Americans impose a tax on imports. Let me ask you about another question, and that has to do with Britain. It's a main surveillance agency today slapped down any suggestion that it helped former President Obama, your former boss, to spy on Trump Tower during last year's campaign. The press secretary, Sean Spicer, had suggested that to explain President Trump's unsupported accusation of what he called wiretapping. Sean Spicer reportedly has apologized to the British embassy. We haven't heard anything from the president about that. But how important is that dispute?
Well, I think, Warren, that the saying is when you're in a hole, stop digging. And the Trump team is in a hole because the president came out and said that President Obama tapped Trump Tower. Leading Republicans on the Hill have said, we see no evidence of this. Then suddenly we hear that it's the Brits that are giving information to the U.S. and President Obama. And Theresa May, the British prime minister, says, what the heck are you talking about? There's no truth to this. And now the White House has to backpedal on this front. So, yes, there are very strong, close links between the intelligence communities in the U.S. and the intelligence communities in the U.K. But I do think that the Trump administration had better get off this this track, because it's just making more and more trouble for itself with an unsubstantiated claim.
Okay, I should say that President Trump has just spoken out to meeting with Angela Merkel before reporters, and he said that the meeting was productive, and he praised Germany's economy as well. We'll find out what the details of that are later on. In the meantime, Charles Kupchan with the Council on Foreign Relations, many thanks as always.
Glad to be back with you, Warren.
In a moment, President Trump's opening offer on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on only back with To the Point. The man who made his name as master of the art of the deal has delivered a budget proposal that will be negotiated for months to come. But it represents President Trump's blueprint for reshaping the American government. That's according to Shane Goldmacher, who writes for Politico. He's now chief White House correspondent for that organization. And thanks a lot for joining our program.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell us, if you will, about what we've heard referred to again and again as the deconstruction of the administrative state. And is that what's involved in this budget?
So that's a line that was coined by Steve Bannon, the president's chief strategist, in his only televised comments since he joined the White House. And he said it last month as sort of one of the pillars of the goals of the Trump administration. And I think that the budget's sort of the most specific expression of that yet. The numbers are pretty stark in a lot of ways. And the big picture is that this budget's not passing. Congress has said it's not happening. But Trump has years to put it in place. And the numbers, again, are pretty stark. At the State Department, they're talking about a 28% cut. At the EPA, a 31% cut. At the Labor Department, a 21% cut. Now, if you've paid attention to budgets, or even if you think that there's fat in government, and there almost certainly is some, 28, 31, 21%, that's not fat at that point. You're taking out significant programs. And this is what they're talking about doing. At the same time, they want to boost spending in the areas of defense and sort of law enforcement. Really fascinating politically, Donald Trump, a Republican president, his first budget does not cut the deficit by a single dollar, does not aim to cut the debt by a single dollar. It's all about restructuring the existing government versus actually shrinking it, which, of course, has been the longtime Republican stated goal.
They don't cut the deficit, but they claim they don't make it any bigger either.
Yeah, their idea was every cut to domestic programs and international aid programs is going to be offset by increases in spending and military-type programs. The budget director described it as a hard power budget. That's a term they used over and over again in advance of the budget and after its rollout yesterday. They want to reshape what American government looks like, not necessarily shrink it. And I think that speaks to the sort of nationalistic platform that Steve Bannon created and that Donald Trump adopted and led him to victory.
You said that the phrase hard power budget was used, and it was budget director Mick Mulvaney who called it that again and again. He was also asked if this is a hard-hearted budget.
We're trying to focus on both the recipients of the money and the folks who give us the money in the first place. And I think it's fairly compassionate to go to them and say, look, we're not going to ask you for your hard-earned money anymore. Single mom of two in Detroit. Okay, give us your money. We're not going to do that anymore unless we can guarantee to you that that money is actually be used in a proper function. And I think that is about as compassionate as you can get.
Compassion, Shane Goldmacher, interesting term when we think of George W. Bush and compassionate conservatism, and particularly when it appears that there will be ultimately, so far we haven't heard from them yet, tax cuts for upper-income people, but not necessarily for that single mom of two in Detroit.
And certainly the health care package, which frankly is the bigger focus right now for the Trump administration. They have votes potentially next week in the House of Representatives. That's the focus. And that package does cut taxes for higher income earners because those taxes were put in place in the health care law put in place under President Obama. The budget that they rolled out was all on the spending side of the ledger. They didn't talk about taxation here and tax levels. You know, Trump has said he would like to overhaul the tax code and include tax cuts, both for those well-off and for the middle class. But for now, this is about how he wants to spend the money they're bringing in. And I think what Mulvaney did there was an interesting sort of turn of phrase. He took the idea of, is this hard-hearted because of the cuts? And he said, no, because we are giving people back money in terms of their taxes. Again, this budget doesn't actually deal with how much people are getting taxed yet. For now, it's all about the spending side.
So once again, as you indicated, this is the vision of the Trump/Bannon administration. And I think you said significantly that they have years to try to negotiate to put it into effect. And we are talking about the man who is the master of the art of the deal. Shane Goldmacher, it's always good to have you on our program. And thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Once again, the Trump budget reflects the president's contempt for the problem of climate change. Here again is Budget Director Mulvaney.
As to climate change, I think the president was fairly straightforward. We're not spending money on that anymore. We consider that to be a waste of your money to go out and do that. So that is a specific tie to his campaign.
David Goldston is Government Affairs Director for the Natural Resources Defense Council. Good to have you with us, as always.
Thanks for having me.
I take it that, once again, there's no surprise about this. The president has sneered at the idea of climate change for a long time.
Well, there's no surprise that they're taking aim at climate change, but the extent is a little bit surprising. They are really looking like they're eliminating almost all research as well as all policy activity. This is an effort not just not to take action on climate, but not to even understand it. And the breadth of that, I think, exceeds what we've seen in the past.
What do you mean by not even trying to understand it? And how important is the research of the American government in that respect?
It's essential. So they're talking about limiting NASA satellite programs, limiting the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration work on it, cutting EPA's research budget basically in half, almost cutting the Department of Energy research budget in half, although more of that's on applied research than understanding the climate problem, cutting U.S. Geological Survey's research, and we haven't even seen a budget yet for the National Science Foundation and some other agencies, and we don't have even all the details on this, but it looks like they're really trying to scour the budget for anything dealing with climate, even anything that would help us understand the nature of the issue, or even just what's happening in terms of gross effects. Even those Republicans who deny the human impact will sometimes say, well, sure, the climate is changing, and obviously that can require actions as well in response to things like rising sea level and so forth. It's not clear we'd even have the information on those gross changes, never mind on what's causing the situation.
So there already are rising sea levels in some important places, including the massive naval base in Norfolk, Virginia. So there's nothing in this budget about doing anything about that?
Nothing that stands out. I mean, the only thing they've really talked about in climate is getting rid of anything that's associated with it. Again, there may be programs left here and there, either because they didn't notice them or because they've decided some small efforts are needed, but that's not apparent in this budget. And, you know, they are attacking and zeroing out other efforts to look at particular bodies of water that are affected by climate, as well as other environmental insults like the Great Lakes and the Chesapeake Bay.
You mentioned the EPA. What about air pollution?
So the talk about the proposal for EPA is a cut of almost a third. It's hard to imagine that the agency could possibly carry out its responsibilities with a cut of that size and a staff cut of about a fifth. The EPA is required by law to update air pollution standards regularly to make sure that they're in line with the latest science. That takes people and money. They need to make sure that companies are actually complying with existing clean air standards. That takes people and money. There's really nothing about clean air that happens automatically, and an agency that is cut by a third just in 1 year, with the prospect of future cuts beyond that, is not going to be able to carry out those basic functions.
David Goldstein, again, Government Affairs Director of the National Resources Defense Council. We'll talk to him as we go along, but that's not all that we want to discuss in terms of the new budget. For many Democrats, the most important issue is the reduction of human services, and here again is Budget Director Mick Mulvaney explaining why there's no money for a very popular program, Meals on Wheels.
We can't spend money on programs just because they sound good and great. Meals on Wheels sounds great. Again, that's a state decision to fund that particular portion of it, to take the federal money and give it to the states and say, look, we want to give you money for programs that don't work. I can't defend that anymore. We cannot defend that anymore. We're $20 trillion in debt. We're going to spend money. We're going to spend a lot of money, but we're not going to spend it on programs that cannot show that they actually deliver the promises that we've made to people.
On CNN, Ellie Hollander, the head of Meals on Wheels, quickly responded to that.
These programs work for everyone. Clients who, millions of them, who rely on Meals on Wheels every day as a lifeline, as the ability to live out their lives at home or independently, safely and healthfully. We know that Meals on Wheels enable seniors to stay out of much more expensive healthcare settings, such as unnecessary visits to the emergency room, admissions, readmissions to hospitals, and also premature placement in long-term care facilities. That saves taxpayers millions of dollars annually.
Rebecca Vallis is Managing Director of the Center for American Progress Poverty Team. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Meals on Wheels, of course, is a tiny program compared to the budget as a whole and to the amount of money spent on human services. Where else are they being reduced, apparently, to find the money to jack up the defense budget?
And the answer is basically everywhere that has a program that serves low and middle income Americans. Part of the twisted irony here is that Trump campaigned as the supposed head of a workers' party. He pledged throughout the campaign to fight for the quote, forgotten man and forgotten woman. But now this budget shows whose side he's really on. And spoiler alert, it's not theirs. He's talked about saving and bringing back jobs. And instead, his budget slashes a whole slew of job training programs. It even closes job centers that help people find work. He makes deep cuts to job-creating infrastructure initiatives as well, and that's after months of claiming that he wants to invest in infrastructure. But in addition, on the human services side, in addition to doing nothing to create jobs or raise wages, he would also eliminate a whole range of housing assistance programs in the middle of a national affordable housing crisis. And then And he would eliminate the U.S. Interagency Commission on Homelessness, which would have its hands even more full after we see a huge spike in homelessness from all of those cuts. He would slash nutrition assistance programs like Meals on Wheels, which you mentioned. He would also cut funding for nutrition assistance to women, infants, and children, a program called WIC, literally taking infant formula out of the bottles of struggling children. And then he would eliminate the entire Legal Services Corporation, which provides federal funding for civil legal aid. That helps people who are facing eviction or foreclosure or domestic violence get lawyers that they otherwise wouldn't be able to afford. And I want to go back to that Spicer quote that you played, because in addition to being incredibly offensive to millions of people across this country, it also makes no sense and just doesn't add up when you think about what Trump is willing to spend money on. We actually crunched the numbers here at the Center for American Progress, and we found that for the cost of 1 month of Trump's trips to Mar-a-Lago in Florida, you could feed more than 5,000 hungry seniors through Meals on Wheels for a year.
It wasn't John Spicer we quoted. It was Mick Mulvaney, who is the budget director for whom, from time to time, Spicer speaks. I want to introduce Dee Davis. He's president of the Center for Rural Strategies and a publisher of Daily Yonder. That is an online news source for rural communities. It's good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Warren.
It's been said, and Republicans seem to be worried about this, that this budget will be most damaging to people in areas where Donald Trump got the most votes. Is that your analysis as well?
It's pretty obvious that here's an area, I mean, I live in an area where 3-1, 4-1, mostly Democrats voted for Trump. All over rural America, there's no way that he was going to be able to win without these huge rural margins to offset the cities, and so his answer back to rural communities is, I don't care. You know, we basically these programs are going to hit a lot of hardscrabble rural communities very hard, and for what reason? No strategic advantage. It's just basically cutting out programs that are often the lifeline for some of these communities. I live in the coal fields. Nobody really thought he was going to bring back coal jobs or build steel mills, but we did think that Trump would preserve the basic lifeline programs that keep people going.
You're in Whitesburg, Kentucky, town of 1,500, not far from the West Virginia border. Nobody there really thinks that the coal business is coming back. But as you say, they did expect the sort of rescue programs, the assistance programs, to continue.
They thought he cared. I mean, I think that everybody understands that rural communities are not top priority in this country. And I think that that's not just true in the coal fields. It's true in the West. It's true in farm territories. It's true in Indian country. But there is some feeling that we want to be recognized as a vital part of the country. We want to be respected, and that's the problem with this budget. When you start eliminating programs or slashing programs that mean a lot, whether it's Meals on Wheels. I mean, think of this. 1 out of 4 rural kids is living below the poverty line. How can you justify cutting women and infant children's nutrition program, which is going to do nothing but exacerbate the problem?
Okay, excuse me. I'm going to interrupt you because we're going to go to a break. We'll come back. We'll continue this conversation with all of our guests on our talking point later, a threat or an apparent threat of preemptive action against North Korea. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI. Warren Olney here, host of To the Point. When I'm not on the air, I like to keep up with podcasts. This American Life and The Daily by The New York Times, they both appeal to me. Sometimes when I ask my otherwise brilliant guests after the show what they listen to, they admit they haven't figured out the whole podcast thing. That's when I remind them you were just on a podcast of To The Point. It's nothing but radio liberated. So if there's a podcast you love, share it with the smart people in your life.
Subscribe to the To The Point podcast at kcrw.com or download the KCRW app, available anywhere podcasts are found and on all mobile devices.
We're only back with To The Point. We've heard today that the first Trump budget is, in fact, a recipe for the deconstruction of the government, which Steve Bannon has advocated, and that it will have years to be negotiated. But it also, according to the guests that we have talked to so far, has cuts in it that could be devastating, particularly, for example, to rural people, children, mothers and children who need food, among other things. Diana Furtka-Ross is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. She's also was chief economist at the Labor Department during the George W. Bush administration, and she was a member of the Trump transition team. Thanks so much for joining our program.
It's great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me on.
We've heard a catalog of horrors about the new budget. How do you respond to it? And is it, in fact, sort of an opening gambit that will then lead to negotiation?
Well, first of all, the president's budgets are generally declared dead on arrival. The House and the Senate want to make their mark on the budgets. So I would say it's not necessarily an opening gambit, but it is definitely not cast in stone. And there are Democrats and Republicans who are finding things wrong with this budget, and it will undoubtedly be changed in many ways. So that's something that people need to understand.
Tell us what the Republicans are concerned about.
Well, there are a variety of different concerns. Some are concerned that the budget does not make any changes to Social Security and Medicare, which are the main drivers of the deficit. Others are concerned that programs in their districts are going to be cut. You know, politicians are politicians, and they always want to look after their own interests in their own states. And even though the deficit has been growing tremendously and the debt now stands at about $20 trillion, it is very, very difficult for politicians to make cuts.
Well, apparently they're not going to increase the debt or the deficit by trying to make the kinds of cuts we've heard about. Well, what about the argument we just heard from Dee Davis that it's in the areas where Trump got the most votes that the most damage, if that's the appropriate term, will occur?
Well, I think that there are cuts throughout. There's the State Department, which has cuts of about 30%, over 30%. So I think that it's difficult to say that the cuts fall disproportionately on rural America. President Trump has cut the budget basically overall in all the departments. And I think it's difficult to say they're going to fall disproportionately on one area. And as you said, President Trump was elected overwhelmingly by voters in rural states. He said he was going to cut the budget. He is fulfilling his campaign promises. And it's very difficult to go from New York City to California and find people who think Washington should be bigger. Most of them think Washington is too big and should be smaller. President Trump is fulfilling his campaign promise.
Let me go back to Dee Davis, the president of the Center for Rural Strategies, publisher of the Daily Yonder in rural Kentucky near the border with West Virginia. Do you think that particularly those Democrats in your area who voted for Donald Trump ever expected to see the kind of cuts that you've just described?
I don't think so. I think that, you know, we're facing 500,000 people in Kentucky losing their coverage with this repeal of Obamacare. I think basically people felt disrespected. They felt like they were out of the loop, and they thought that Trump was a breath of fresh air. And so they embraced Trump. The government's not getting smaller. They're going to spend as much money. It's just that they're throwing bones to wealthy people, and they're hitting poor people harder. And certainly in a lot of rural communities that voted for Trump, they're getting hit the hardest.
Diana Furstgott-Roth, what about that, particularly when we're told there are going to be tax cuts at the very high income levels, not so much in the middle and at the lower levels?
Well, given that the top 50% of earners pay 97% of all federal individual income taxes, it's very difficult to do a tax cut and have the bottom 50% of individual earners get tax cuts, although President Trump has promised increased child care credits and other kinds of credits that would be refundable. And that would be instead of tax cuts. So he said he wants to help parents with child care. But I think overwhelmingly people were also against the Affordable Care Act under the proposed Republican legislation, which President Trump has said he supports. Low-income individuals would receive advanceable refundable credits so they can go and buy insurance on the open market rather than be limited to the Obamacare exchanges, where premiums have been rising by 25%, 30%, sometimes even 60% in 1 year. So there was vast dissatisfaction with the Affordable Care Act, and that's one major reason that Trump got elected president.
Dee Davis, Kentucky was one of the places where they embraced the Affordable Care Act more than almost in any other state. How do people there feel about the changes that the Republicans are making?
Well, I think that people aren't sure how they got their coverage, but they're going to be darn sure what happened if they lose it. And I think that to come back and to kick people off of their health care, but to promise them some kind of different tax credit or a voucher that they can use on an open market. When we're seeing these numbers come in and it's showing extreme increases, particularly for older rural citizens, these guys are trying to sell something that nobody's going to buy.
Let me go back to Rebecca Vallis. She is Managing Director of the Poverty Team at the Liberal Center for American Progress. When we talk about the proportionality of these cuts budget between one department and another, and on the one hand, we're talking about the environment or the military being increased, and on the other hand, we're talking about services that go to individuals in need. Is there a moral aspect to all this?
I think there absolutely is. I think it's often said that budgets are moral documents. And so while it's a lot of people might dismiss this budget and say, oh, it's just a blueprint, don't worry, it's not going to become law, it is the clearest articulation we've seen yet of President Trump's actual priorities and where they lie. We've seen a lot of talk throughout the campaign. We've seen a lot of talk since he took office. He's made promises to bring about shared prosperity or to give power back to the people. But really, the rubber meets the road when you see policy priorities in a budget like you see here. And to the point about who's going to be hit hardest, there really is actually an empirical case that rural and small town America is going to bear the brunt of these human services cut, which really is an incredibly twisted irony considering they were a lot of the folks who came out and voted for him in November. And that's because one in three Americans in those rural and small town counties that voted for Trump are living paycheck to paycheck. That is substantially higher, 24% higher than folks who live in urban counties, and it's a lot higher than the rest of the nation as well. So these are the people who need Meals on Wheels, who need those jobs, and who place their bets on Trump to improve their economic circumstances. They weren't voting for tax cuts for the already wealthy and for corporations. They were saying, please, Trump, help me and people like me.
Diana Furstgott-Roth, back to you at the Manhattan Institute. You once again were on the Trump transition team. Mr. Mulvaney of the Budget Office says that the housing and urban development cuts will not actually kick anybody out of their housing. Does the administration quarrel with the kind of figures we're hearing from our other guests about the devastating effects that these cuts are going to have on human beings.
I think that what's being left out is what would have happened without Trump. And state health insurance premiums went up by as much as 47% this year. The Golden Rule Insurance Company wanted to increase premiums by 65%, but the insurance commissioners only granted only a 47% increase. So the Affordable Care Act is really hurting people, to go back to the point of our previous guest. But in terms of helping the economy, there are two ways we could do it. We could keep people dependent on these welfare programs, or we could try and grow the economy. President Trump is going to grow the economy so that people can get off these programs. One way is by rolling back environmental and labor regulations and lowering tax rates so companies come back and create jobs in the United States. And some of these regulations have put coal mining out of business. That can come back. Regulations as to the corporate tax rates, the highest in the world right now. Corporate tax rates are keeping out income that wants to come back to the United States, because we are one of the few countries that tax companies on their worldwide earnings, not just on their territorial earnings in the United States. And we have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. So I truly believe that we will see an increase in jobs in the United States. We've seen the stock market go up since Trump was elected. We've seen very large numbers of jobs created over the past few months. We've seen the labor force participation rate rise. We've seen the unemployment rate go down. So things are going very well. People are going to be able to get jobs instead of welfare.
Okay. David Goldston, back to you, Government Affairs Director at the National Resources Defense Council. What about the argument that if we reduce the kinds of restrictions that are going to be taken away from the Environmental Protection Agency, that in fact then the economy will be able to grow, corporations will be freed up, perhaps the coal mining business will come back after all, even though that seems to be greeted with skepticism by Dee Davis and others. But is that a powerful argument for making these kinds of changes?
No, it's an extremely weak argument in a number of ways. First of all, in terms of the coal industry, jobs, unfortunately, have been declining since at least the early 1960s, before there even was an Environmental Protection Agency. Almost everyone will tell you that most of the job decline is due to competition from natural gas and other worldwide economic changes. There's a reason that most people, even in the coal communities, are skeptical about these promises about coal regulations or not. Close to the primary issue there. In other areas, most studies will show that actually the regulation, when you talk to industry, doesn't turn out to be the primary thing they're concerned about, and that the costs of regulation are far outstripped by the benefits. But even if you accepted some of those arguments, what Trump and the GOP and Congress are doing is not talking about tinkering around the edges of the system. With the budget and with some of the regulatory proposals, both executive orders and legislation, they're literally talking about shutting the entire regulatory system down. So all the advances we've had on clean air, clean water, protected land since at least the 1970s, you wouldn't be tinkering around the edges with those. You'd be able to make no additional progress whatsoever. And they're also, in many cases, especially climate, talking about reversing the progress we've already made. So this won't bring it back jobs, but we know it will bring back pollution.
Very, very quickly, where do you think the impacts will be the greatest?
Well, we think on climate, on clean air, on clean water, these won't just be limited to any specific geographic area, because what they're talking about is undoing the entire national system on which progress is made. Again, they support legislation that would make it literally impossible to put future safeguards in place.
And there will be oil and gas drilling on public lands, will there not, as well as a reduction in the National Park Service?
That's correct. I mean, the budget is vague, but it makes clear that it wants to not only increase oil and gas drilling on public lands, but they've basically cutting almost in half programs in the Department of Energy that have been essential to increasing the affordability and the effectiveness of solar and wind power.
And Dee Davis, what about water quality in rural areas?
Well, we just had the rollback of the protection in mining areas. You can now go back to dumping coal acid runoff back into the creeks. It's like that's not going to bring back coal jobs. That's nothing but a one way to take care of some of the donors, but it's not going to make this area more attractive. It's not going to help us build new industry, and it's not going to help take care of people who are already dealing with a high rate of illness and the country's shortest life expectancy.
That's a big issue for rural voters, correct? Clean water?
Yeah, I mean, you have to have water if you live in a lot of places in the cities, in the suburbs, don't understand how difficult it is to get potable water in rural communities, how precious it is, and how easy it is to foul water supply.
Rebecca Vallis, back to you with the Center for American Progress. What about the argument that, many Republicans are having problems with this, particularly if the kind of issues that we're talking about occur in their districts, that no budget, as we heard earlier, is ever passed the first time around, and every one of them is the opening in a long negotiation. Are you at all reassured by the idea that the negotiations can change this, can, in fact, alleviate some of the issues that you've been and the others have been concerned about?
Well, I think the fact that there are already Republicans balking at what I'm calling a scorched earth budget really reflects how unpopular all of the policies contained in it are. And again, how out of step it is with what Americans were actually asking for when they went to the ballot box in November. And this is really of a piece with the resistance that we've seen in the streets, particularly during recess periods when members of Congress are home and are doing town halls in their districts. Men and women and children have been taking to those town halls, and they have been demanding answers from their members of Congress, saying, how can you take away health insurance from my child with a disability who wouldn't be alive today if not for Medicaid, and which your health plan, which would make massive cuts to the Medicaid program as part of its Affordable Care Act repeal, would do? Those are the kinds of questions that they're asking of their members in Congress, and Republicans are starting to feel the heat, and I think that's what we're going to see play out with this budget. But it still does remain important because it is the clearest articulation of Trump's policies and priorities that we've seen to date, and it shows he's fighting for millionaires and billionaires just like him, not the forgotten man and the forgotten woman he pledged to protect.
Okay, that's all the time we have, and I want to thank you all very much for being on our program. Rebecca Vallis is with the Poverty Team at the Center for American Progress, liberal organization. Diana Furstgott-Roth is with the Manhattan Institute, conservative place. She was with the George W. Bush administration and a member of the Trump Transition Team. Dee Davis is president of the Center for Rural Strategies and publisher of the Daily Yonder in rural Kentucky. David Goldston is with the National Resources Defense Council. And thanks to our earlier guest, Shane Goldmacher, the chief White House correspondent for Politico. When we come back, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, a rare public moment in South Korea. This is To the Point from Public Radio International.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_KCRW.
Warren Ana here with today's talking point. On his trip to Asia, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson cut short his visit with South Korean officials due to fatigue. He is going on to China. The fatigue is, according to the South Korean Herald, Tillerson has not allowed American reporters to travel with him. In a rare public appearance, though, he said this about North Korea's nuclear program.
The United States calls on North Korea to abandon its nuclear and ballistic missile programs and refrain from any further provocations. The U.S. commitment to the defense of Japan and its other treaty allies through the full range of our military capabilities is unwavering. In the face of this ever-escalating threat, it is clear that a different approach is required.
Now, that has been widely interpreted as a threat of preemptive action, although Tillerson did not use those words. Nicholas Burns was ambassador to NATO, undersecretary of state for political affairs during the George W. Bush administration. He's now a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Welcome back, as always.
Thank you very much.
Is this fundamentally different from the policies of the Bush and Obama administrations?
Well, Warren, I think what Secretary Tillerson was signaling today on the eve of his visit to Beijing to see Xi Jinping is that the policy of the six-party talks did not work. That was President George W. Bush, President Obama for a time. The policy of the agreed framework with President Clinton way back in 1994 didn't work. When you have a deal with the North Koreans, and we've had two over the last 23 years, the North Koreans have violated both of them. So I think he's right to say we can't go back there. I think he's talking tough because he wants to get the attention of the Chinese government. I did not read his statement today to argue for preemptive military action. I read it as saying, when I listened to him and then read his remarks, he was saying that if the North Koreans attacked or threatened South Korea or U.S. forces in the Korean Peninsula, of course, they'd defend themselves. That's standard U.S. policy. But he's looking for the Chinese government, which has leverage. China supplies North Korea with its coal, most of its energy, and with a lot of its food. He's looking to signal to the Chinese that we're going to rate our relationship with China based in part on China's ability to help contain this threat from North Korea. And that's a very logical course, I think, for Secretary Tillerson to take.
I just want to pursue this phrase, the preemptive action, for a moment, because it did appear in the New York Times. And it's my understanding that if there were preemptive action, it might be disastrous for South Korea, because North Korea is prepared to basically take out the city of Seoul, is it not?
Well, yeah, I think it would be entirely too risky to initiate military action preemptively against North Korea without cause. The cause would be if we felt that the North Koreans were attacking us or had attacked or were about to. But if that's not the situation, I don't believe that Secretary Tillerson was talking about some kind of military aggression against North Korea. For the reasons you cited, Warren, they have nuclear weapons. We know that they are a tough, hard-edged regime that would use a lot of its power to try to decimate Seoul, which is just, you know, tens of miles, 25, 30 miles south of the demilitarized zone, and a lot of American forces and South Korean forces standing in the way. So I saw it as a hardening of the U.S. position, but it was not an irresponsible statement.
What about the fact that the Secretary of State is not allowing American reporters to travel with him? They can sort of get in on the sidelines if they possibly can, as they did in the case of this statement that we just heard. Would it be easier to understand what he's talking about if there were greater access?
Well, I think it, you know, with all due respect, and I do respect Secretary Tillerson, obviously, I think it's a mistake not to travel with the American press. This is the press has traveled with our secretaries of state for a good 65 to 70 years. This has become routine. There's two advantages to it. Number one, a situation like today, if rather than have the South Korean press say that he's tired, there may be a logically good reason why he didn't have the dinner with the South Korean foreign minister, and just talking to the American press would have cleared that up. Secondly, we live in a democracy, and those in government, in the executive branch, have a responsibility to be transparent as much as possible with the U.S., with the American people through the press, and to be accountable to the press. The press has First Amendment freedoms in the United States, as you well know, being a journalist yourself. And so there are many reasons why we need to set that example. And I hope very much that Secretary Tillerson will begin again to do what every single one of his predecessors for decades has done, and that's travel with the American press.
Talking with Nicholas Burns, formerly with the George W. Bush administration. So Tillerson says the U.S. won't engage in talks unless the North Koreans give up weapons of mass destruction, or the program of developing weapons of mass destruction. You say the United States is trying to put pressure on China to help bring that about. That hasn't worked in the past either.
It hasn't, because the Chinese don't particularly care for Kim Jong-un, the dictator in North Korea. In fact, they seem frustrated by him. But they do fear something else, and that is they fear a collapse of North Korea, a unification of the Korean Peninsula with Seoul as the capital, and a Korea that would then be aligned with the United States as its ally. China doesn't want that. Korea, North Korea, of course, borders China, and they don't want to see the United States gain that strategic foothold. So they've been withholding full support from President Obama and President Bush and President Bill Clinton in the past because there's a limit to what the Chinese want to do to help us. We have to signal to the Chinese that we have a particular problem now. If the North Koreans develop an intercontinental ballistic missile with a nuclear warhead and they can deliver that, they can reach California where you're sitting, in Santa Monica or Los Angeles or Santa Barbara or San Francisco, in the next 5 to 10 years, that's unacceptable to the United States. China has to help us make sure that doesn't happen, that North Korea gains that technological reach. We can't afford to have this 33-year-old dictator hold our most important state, economically, certainly, California, in hostage. And so there's a time, this is a time to ratchet up the pressure on China to make clear to the North Koreans we're not going to sit by and allow them to develop this capacity that could hit the west coast of the United States, and hopefully through sanctions, and then I think Warren eventually through face-to-face conversations, diplomacy between North Korea and the United States, maybe involving the Chinese, certainly involving South Korea and Japan. At some point, you've got to get back to that. You've got to deal with your adversaries, but from a position of strength, and that's where I think Secretary Tillerson was right to do, say what he did today. We need to be in a strong position to get the attention of Pyongyang and of Beijing.
Aren't the Chinese also concerned that if there's a collapse of North Korea, they will see a lot of refugees coming across the border into China?
They are. That's one of their direct concerns. They don't want to have to deal with that. That would be a major humanitarian catastrophe. It could unsettle parts of China as well.
And quickly, I'm sorry to interrupt, but yeah. A point that I want to make before we run out of time. What about these conversations that you're talking about? Who's going to do it when their State Department isn't staffed up?
It's a major problem. The Trump administration is running the slowest transition, I think, ever. Major parts of the State Department are not staffed by the leadership. They haven't even appointed undersecretaries and assistant secretaries. They need to act on that quickly.
Out of time, a former Ambassador Nicholas Burns, as always, thanks for being
thanks,
on our
Warren.
Program. To the Point, produced this week by Katie Cooper, Andrea Brody, Sasha Woodruff, Luke Vanderplug, Yale, Evan Orr, and Christine Detz. Our technical directors, Mike Newport and Joel Stein, managing producer, Evan George. Thanks to the John Coltrane family as well. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast is a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.